Chapter 5, Harvard Drug Research. Fall 1960, Cambridge, Massachusetts. In early September, the kids and I moved to Newton Center, a Boston suburb about 5 miles from Cambridge. When Frank came over to visit me, he unpacked a suitcase filled with books about visionary experiences. If I were you, he said, I'd read William James first. James, the father of the Harvard psychology department, was, to my surprise, an advocate of brain change drugs. In The Will to Believe, 1897, he raved about his experiences with nitrous oxide. After reading James, Frank showed me the writings of Morton Prince, the Harvard psychologist for whom our center was named, another pioneer American psychologist who recognized the importance of altered states of consciousness. Next, Frank took me around to meet Harry Murray, a wizard of personality assessment. Murray, as the head of the OSS-CIA psychology department, had monitored military experiments on brainwashing and sodium amytal interrogation. Murray expressed great interest in our drug research project and offered his support. Just across the street, at the entrance of Harvard Yard, we would often wander into the Swedenborgian Chapel, where William James had listened to his father preach on transcendental scientific visions. By this time, believe me, I felt like I was being initiated into a secret order of Cambridge Illuminati. Frank smiled when I mentioned this idea. The word of our project spread through the Harvard Yard, and in a few days, several graduate students came around to volunteer their services. Looking back, I can see that the seeds of our political troubles with other faculty members were sown during the first initial meetings of this research group. We decided to make our research project existential transactional. That meant we would not follow the medical model of giving drugs to others and then observing only the external results. First, we would teach ourselves how to use the drugs and how to run sessions. Since we were using a strange new kind of inner microscope, one which made visible an extraordinary range of new perceptions, our first obvious task was to develop manuals on how to focus the new tools. The scientists we trained could then use the drugs precisely and safely on themselves and others to study any and all effects of psychology, aesthetics, philosophy, religion, life. First, though, we had to obtain the drugs. One graduate student told us that Sandoz Laboratory, the Swiss firm that had developed LSD, had synthesized the active ingredient of the mushrooms, and their branch office in New Jersey would send it to qualified researchers. I dictated a letter on Harvard stationery requesting a supply of psilocybin. While waiting, George introduced me to Aldous Huxley's book on mescaline and LSD. Huxley entranced us with his uncanny ability to relate the sometimes chaotic events in an activated, turned-on brain to the perennial issues of aesthetics and ontology. After 6 weeks, we had run psilocybin mushroom sessions on 15 staff members. We learned a lot about dosage and the importance of setting, that is, the tone of the environment, which included the people attending the session. We soon discovered that strong bonds tend to develop among those who shared a session. We seemed to need to see each other, to be close to each other for a week after the experience. For this reason, we decided that each explorer, each researcher, should be allowed to invite family members and close friends to participate. Inevitably, we mushroom researchers began to hang out together, enjoying the deep attachments and enthusiasms that pioneers always share. Meanwhile, unfortunately, drifting away from former friends. At that time, in the early 60s, this trip was so powerful, so different, so shattering to one's illusions of a single reality that the people who had experienced it inevitably formed an in-group. This difference between those who wanted to explore new brain terrain and those who reflexively avoided this challenge foreshadowed and predicted the bitter cultural conflict that was to rage everywhere in the decades to come. The question that haunted our work in these early days was this: how could we introduce these methods for mind expansion to society? I raised this issue with Huxley one day at the faculty club. Why don't I come over to your place tonight, said Aldous Huxley. We'll take the drug and ask our expanded brain that question. Around sunset, I built a fire while Aldous stacked the books he had brought with him on a coffee table, then stretched himself out on the couch. We each took psilocybin. For the next 3 hours, we listened to music. Bach, Mozart, African drums, Indian chants, Ravi Shankar. Occasionally, we waved reassurance to each other or murmured comments of bliss. And then Elvis sat up, his lanky legs crossed, and he looked at me quizzically. So, you don't know what to do with this bloody philosopher's stone we have stumbled onto. He laughed. In the past, you know, this powerful knowledge has been guarded in privacy, passed down in the subdued metaphorical obscurantism of scholars and mystics and artists. Hey, I responded, society needs this information. My anti-elitist American button had been pushed. No, warned Aldous Huxley, these are evolutionary matters. They cannot be rushed. Work privately. Initiate artists, writers, poets, jazz musicians, elegant courtesans, painters, rich bohemians. And they, in turn, will initiate the intelligent rich. That's how everything of culture and beauty and philosophic freedom has been passed on in the past. Well, we fell into silence. The fireplace threw dancing colors around the room. It was a meadow of serenity. Huxley's eyes were closed. A beatific smile played around his thin mouth. Suddenly, he clapped his hands against his bony leg. Your role, he said, is quite simple. Become a cheerleader for evolution. That's what I did and my grandfather before me. These brain drugs, mass-produced in the laboratories, will bring about vast changes in society. This will happen with or without you or me. All we can do is spread the word. The obstacle to this evolution, Timothy, is the Judeo-Christian Bible. Bible? I don't remember any discussion of brain change drugs in the Bible, said I. Timothy, have you forgotten the very first chapters of Genesis, where Jove says to Adam and Eve, I have built you this wonderful resort eastward of Eden, and you can do anything you want, except you are forbidden to eat of the tree of knowledge. I laughed. The first control substances, huh? Exactly, said Aldous Huxley. The Bible begins with food and drug prohibitions. I began to see what he meant. So the fall and original sin were caused by the taking of illegal drugs. By this time, Aldous was chuckling away, very, very pleased with himself, and I was rolling on the floor with laughter. Timothy, said Aldous, you must expect opposition. There are people in this society who will do everything within their considerable power to stop our research. You're saying it ain't going to be easy, I replied. That's precisely what I'm saying, Huxley said. The managers of consciousness, from the Vatican to Harvard, have been in this business for a long, long time, and they're not about to give up their monopoly. And, after all, they are the experts, and we're the amateurs. They're the pros, and we're just the beginners. I said it again to Aldous Huxley. It ain't gonna be easy.